Coming up on KUCB News, Ray Hudson on art and identity in the Aleutians, and the Alaska National Guard wants more Alaska Native members. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Aleutian Family Dentistry, cultivating a community of healthy smiles. Dr. MacArthur and his team will be in Unalaska during the month of May. Services include dental exams, cleanings, pediatric children's dentistry, braces including Invisalign, implants, fillings, extractions including wisdom teeth extractions, crowns, sedation dentistry, teeth whitening, and much more. All insurance is accepted, including Denali Kid Care and Medicaid. Appointments available by calling 581-3122.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Zoe Sobel with some local news on Wednesday, May 30th, 2018. There's a long history of art in the Aleutians. When explorers came to the region, Ray Hudson says they were accompanied by artists, but that art tells us little about what was going on at the time.
I mean, these were not artists who wanted to capture personalities or capture situations. They were like photographers. You know, they were a supplement to the men who were drawing maps. They would draw a picture of the coastline so people would have an idea of what to look for. They would draw what they called the national characteristics of people, basically stereotypes, and what kind of clothing people wore.
Hudson says in the late 20th century, the fact that art said little about conditions in the Aleutians started to change. Hudson is back in Unalaska working on his next project on art and identity. He's focused in particular on four artists, Gert Savarni, Carolyn Reed, Mike Rasmussen, and Jara Chadwick.
There still is a large number of artists that work in the Aleutians and do beautiful work. But these four, I think, were really super passionate about their art. I mean, they were consumed by it.
You can hear Hudson talk about his next project. That conversation starts at 6 p.m. tonight at the Museum of the Aleutians. 75 years ago, Japan and the United States were locked in one of the bloodiest battles fought on American soil, the Battle of Attu. The island is at the end of the Aleutian chain, closer to Japan than Seattle. Army veteran Alan Serrell is still haunted by the experience of staring down young men like himself.
Some of the guys noticed that it was bothering me. And they said, look, you kill or be killed. It's your own life that you're protecting. And they were right.
The battle is unfamiliar to most, save World War II buffs, but it saved the lives of countless soldiers in the future. A note to listeners, one of the people in this story uses a word that is offensive for Japanese people.
Through the early morning haze of the Arctic day, United States troops are on the move, streaming in by the thousands to take up strategic positions somewhere in Alaska.
The United News Company documented the Aleutian campaign. In 1943, American troops were streaming into Alaska in preparation for one of the deadliest battles of World War II. That's because 1 year earlier, Japanese soldiers bombed Dutch Harbor, seized Attu Island, and took the Alaska Native people who lived there as prisoners of war. It was the first time American soil had been invaded since the War of 1812. Soldiers like Bob Brocklehurst of the 18th Fighter Squadron were told that the Japanese were looking to invade the lower 48 by way of the Aleutian chain.
They figured that the Japanese, if they had wanted to, could have come clear up in the Aleutians, taken Anchorage, and come down the east coast of Anchorage, past down Vancouver to Seattle, Washington.
But according to historian Jeff Dickrell, the Battle of Attu was really about reclaiming the stolen island.
There was a propaganda value in that. Some of the higher ranking people in the Joint Chiefs of Staff really wanted this cleared, the Aleutians cleared. They wanted to be able to say that the Japanese had been cleared from American soil.
Because the Japanese had the advantage of time, the Americans attacked with quadruple the force, more than 12,000 soldiers.
Beneath the barrage of a battleship's guns, United States forces move in to drive the Japanese from rocky, fog-bound Attu. strategic island in the Aleutian chain.
In this 1943 United News newsreel, soldiers clamber onto small boats overflowing with gear, motored ashore, and land on Attu.
The problem of supplying an expedition to take this vital subarctic outpost is tremendous. But the Americans are well trained for landing such as this, and they're bringing everything they'll need to hold Attu against any future attack.
The Americans brought heavy equipment, but the lack of roads made it useless. Signal Corps Sergeant Alan Serrell recalled his experience in an interview with the National Park Service.
It was strictly a foot job. You had to walk, you had to carry your equipment.
The battle started on May 11th. It was supposed to last a few days, but because of the conditions, it stretched to 19. The Americans slowly advanced on the Japanese from the north and south, slogging their way through snowy tundra. The Japanese were camped out high in the foggy mountains above the visibility line, and as the Americans sent scouts up into the hills to locate them, small skirmishes would break out when the two forces met. Many soldiers were young and inexperienced. Some had been training in the deserts of California for deployment in North Africa, so they weren't expecting the brutal Aleutian weather. It was constantly raining or snowing. But Serrell says worst of all was the wind.
You'd be walking along and all of a sudden you're flat on your face. It was unbearable. If you wanted to point a rifle, you just couldn't do it.
Not only that, soldiers like Joseph Sasser didn't have clothing suitable for the conditions.
We did have rain suits, but that could prove a disadvantage to you because of, as you were walking and so forth, you perspire. You didn't get enough air and you perspired. And then when you sat down to take a break, then you got cold.
Sasser was luckier than others. His clothes were wool, but he remembers some were sent with summer uniforms and struggled with chills up in the mountains. Poorly constructed leather boots that never dried and were difficult to untie led to trench foot, where tissue would die and feet would blacken and decay. On top of all that, Dickrell says the Americans had never gone head-to-head with the Japanese on land. Every other battle had happened in the sky or at sea.
When you fight on an island, there's nowhere to retreat to. So it is a battle to the end. There's no retreat. There's nowhere to go. And we didn't know how the Japanese would react to that.
By the end of May, both sides were feeling the toll of the battle. Food and supplies were scarce. The Japanese were down to 800 able-bodied men.
We didn't know if they would surrender once they were surrounded or it was obvious they were going to lose. We didn't know if they would fight to the end, every single person. And the last thing we expected was a mass suicide.
The Japanese soldiers followed the Bushido Code, a samurai warrior ethic where surrender was dishonorable. They didn't expect to defeat the Americans. They expected to die fighting. Every Japanese soldier who could walk assembled for a final bonsai charge, trying to catch the Americans off guard. 20-year-old Sasser was part of that last stand on Engineer Hill.
The Japanese just kept coming up the ravines, stacked on top of each other. And some, seeing that everything was futile, nothing they could do, they just took their hand grenades and pulled a pin on it and blew their stomach out completely.
Serrell was there, too. He heard the commotion and ran over.
When the Japs came running at us, yelling and screaming, you know, they were ridiculous. They had the grenades wrapped around their forehead or around their chest. We lost quite a number of guys from the grenades.
549 Americans died fighting. The Japanese casualties were catastrophic. 2,300 men died, and only 28 soldiers were captured. Both Serrell and Sasser helped bury the dead in mass graves. But the real killer on Attu was the weather and disease. It took more American soldiers out of action than the Japanese. A Pathé news clip describes the scene.
After 3 weeks of costly fighting, Attu was taken, marking the first major American victory since Guadalcanal. Japan's high water mark advance was stopped dead. A turning tide proved a military milestone of the century.
After this battle, with so many unexpected losses, the U.S. stepped back and tried to learn from it. Attu veterans were interviewed so that other soldiers could be better trained and prepared for the cold conditions. Changes were also made to Army footwear, clothes, outdoor gear, and food to prevent injuries. While they were too late to save the lives and limbs of Attu veterans, military officials credit the lessons learned with preventing casualties in the Italian campaign. But many of those who fought in the cold and dodged the Japanese grenades came through the experience with more complicated feelings. Looking back on the battle, Cyril says it was hard to wrap his mind around his own survival.
When something good happened, I looked up and I said, "Thank you, God." What it did was it made me feel good to know that the war was that the war with the Japanese was over and that I survived it. Mm-hmm. But what about the poor guys that didn't survive it? Japanese or American? Pure luck. What else can you say?
After the fighting died down, Cyril remained stationed on Attu. He spent time exploring the island, collecting samples of plants and filling a book with pressed flowers. Now, 75 years later, he says he hasn't forgotten the battle. Back then, it bothered him to shoot people, and that's still true today.
And when you see people fall, you know, fall, it does something to you. I keep thinking, these people, they either have wives or they have parents. How different are they from us? They're wearing a different uniform.
Today, Attu is uninhabited. The Attuans who survived imprisonment in Japan were never allowed to return home. The only hint of the island's wartime history is the abandoned equipment left to rust. The Battle of Attu ended 75 years ago today. And the Alaska National Guard is trying to recruit more Alaska Native soldiers. Colonel Wayne Dawn visited Kodiak last week in an attempt to grow Alaska Native National Guard participants to a number more representative of the state population. Dawn says about 8.5% of the entire Army Guard and 3-4% of the Air Guard is Alaska Native.
Over a period of time, since the end of the Cold War, the participation of Alaska Natives has diminished, and with that, a lot of the able-bodied young men who would otherwise provide assistance during local emergencies and state emergencies, you know, so we lack presence out in some of our communities there.
Don says the Rural Guard Initiative, which they established a few years ago, is focused on bringing in Alaska Native soldiers, especially to the Army Guard.
As is going on in the rest of the country, there are entrance barriers for a lot of young men and women in terms of medical and academic or score entrance scores. And so with our initiative, we're able to waive some of those initial entry requirements to increase the number of participants.
Ideally, he says they'd like soldiers stationed in every community, but they just don't have enough qualified people to serve yet. Don says they hope to build to at least 50 members in these first few years. And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Zoe Sobel. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org. Please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecast. We'll be right back.